This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's edition of Jerry's Talking Podcast. I'm David Campbell, your host, and I am joined by someone who enjoys this time of year because it is basketball wall-to-wall, Mr. Terry Pluto. Terry, how's it going?
I am doing well.
Great. Hey, let's get into it. I think we should start with the Cavs, and then maybe we'll talk some Women's Final Four since it's down at the Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse. We've got some Guardians to get into. We got some good foul ball stories. Let's start with the Cavs, Terry. You've been writing about the struggles they've been having. They're only, a half game up on the Knicks for third place in the East right now. I was looking, I think that as of today, we're taping this late on Tuesday, they're only 3.5 games out of a play-in tournament spot. Are you worried about this team, Terry? And if so, how worried are you with 7 games left?
Yeah, I'm worried because I'm not sure who's going to play or who's going to do what. The Mitchell injury hangs over this whole franchise right now, and Chris Fedor is so connected. It's remarkable the stuff he gets, and you know Donovan's been telling him the knee is not right. I think he played 4 games in March, shot like 30% from the field. I was shocked to see that. 60% of the shots were from 3-point range. He's not even trying to drive. His passing is still good. It's really good, and I just feel somewhat more confident with the ball in his hands than Garland's right now. But if he's not out there scoring 25 points and doing, Donovan Mitchell things in terms of, he's always near the top of the league in steals and deflections. And if he's really having to play kind of passive basketball to hide the knee, I mean, they're in big trouble.
And I think this was in your column, Terry, or maybe it was Chris Fedor's reporting. I'm not sure, but they're 11-13 without Mitchell this season. Mm-hmm. And they have a net rating of plus 7.4 with him on the court, and they're minus 1.5 net rating with him off. I mean, that just puts numbers behind what you were just saying.
Basically, he's worth 9 points a game difference is what it really is. And the other thing that, like, in the last 5 games that they've lost, Darius Garland shooting like 35% and averaging 13 points and just having a really hard time, which is why in my column I'm suggesting not that Mitch Strus be the full-time point guard or anything like that, but Strus is 6'5". He's got some point guard skills. I think he's the most underrated player on the team because especially the good teams, are jumping out and they're double-teaming Garland, and he's having a hard time with it.
So I wanted to get into that a little bit, Terry, about Darius Garland. And I think you mentioned this last week on the podcast. You think that given all the facial hits that he's taken and the eye injuries and everything, that he's a little shy going to the basket. Mm-hmm. Are you still seeing that?
Yes. Yeah, I am. And maybe we don't know how he is physically. He may be more beat up than we realize. It's very clear to me he's having trouble breaking double teams and things where in the past he was able to do it. I don't know why that is. Just saying, this is what I see, and my guess is it's what many fans are seeing based on the emails I'm receiving. And so the key thing, the best backcourt, by the way, they had by far, or excuse me, the best pairing of two players, to be exact, is Mitchell and Strus, by far. I mean, actually, Garland and Mitchell weren't as bad as I thought they would be. They're sort of in the middle, but that's that's a combination that I really like together. That's a combination, I think, that in the playoffs could be effective, where you go bigger and then you have a Corliss small forward and you have your two big guys out there. They won't do it, but I might bring Garland off the bench. Maybe it's hard to do it at this point now with Mitchell hurt, but that would be, you know, something. He's a max player. He's made an all-star team. Well, a lot of basketball is fit in combinations, and you need to get, first of all, if I'm Bickerstaff, the last thing I'd be worried about, like, somebody's feelings at this point. I've got to figure out how to win some games.
Oh, yeah, there's no time for that.
Yeah. I got to figure out what to do here. You know, Mobley seems to be coming around some. So that's, you know, that's a plus thing. Jared Allen's been there all year for them once he got healthy. And don't you notice, David, how when Mitchell plays, Allen is just so much better?
Well, he's one of those guys that makes everybody else around him better. And Darius Garland has done that in the past, but I'm not seeing that from him this year. I was curious, Terry, after what you said last week, I wanted to see if there was any data to kind of, you know, buttress your opinion or maybe if there was something we were missing.
Sure.
So Garland, his scoring average from last season to this season hasn't just gone down. It was 21.6 last year. He's down to 18.0 this year. But he last season he shot 4 free throws a game, and this season he's shooting 2.7. I'm sorry, that's free throws made.
Yeah.
4 per game and 2.7. He attempted 4.7 free throws last season, and he's attempting 3.2. That's like a free throw and a half per game less. He's also shooting less from the free throw line when he does get there, 863 to 834. And then this is interesting too, Terry. His personal fouls per game were 2.1 last year, and it's down to 1.7. So he's not fouling as much on defense. I don't know if that implies that he's not sticking his nose into as many scores.
He's not guarding anybody.
Yeah, so like it just seems like he's not getting to the free throw line. He's not defending as hard. He's not fouling. I didn't pull his defensive numbers in terms of defensive rating or anything like that. But the free throw numbers going down, I mean, how many times have we seen him go into the lane with a nice little teardrop? That's like part of his game. And if he's reluctant to go in there because of everything he's been through, like, yes, we can understand that. But that's a big problem for the Cavs if he's not going to be bringing that to their offense.
Yeah, but the biggest one, David, is when they jump out and blitz him on defense and he has trouble getting the offense set up in that. And maybe the other problem is because he's not breaking those double teams, so therefore he's not getting past the defense. He's not getting into the line even to begin with. That could be another problem. This is not to put it all on Garland, but the combination of Garland having the worst year of his career since his rookie season and Mitchell being hurt of late. I mean, in January and February, they went 20-6. And they didn't have Garland, and I mean, I think he played like 13 of those games, and Mobley missed a bunch of them. But they were cooking with Mitchell and Strus and George Niang and Allen and that group. And then they go 7-10 in March, and the March schedule was harder and it was more compact. But nonetheless, it was to me very discouraging to see that. And so as we go into April, I don't know what we're going to see. I really don't, because I don't know what the team's going to look like. And that's a really bad place to be with the playoffs coming. That is why I would rest Mitchell the next, they have like 5 games left or 6 games. He would play maybe, I know you want to stay out of the play-in tournament or whatever, but you got to beat a few of these teams with what you've got. And I would bring Mitchell back maybe for a last regular season game just to make sure he's ready to go for the playoffs. And if that meant putting the ball in Strus's hands more often, or the other guy who actually is shockingly impressed me with his good point guard skills is LeVert. I want somebody to get the ball up the court and get things set up better than Garland has been doing. And I never thought that's something I would say.
Well, and as you pointed out, Terry, just the physical demands of carrying the team, it just seems to be too much for him right now with, like you said, with the blitzes and everything, the physical defenders are throwing at him. I think you're right. The Cavs have 7 games left, right, just to reset that. They're at Utah tonight, and then they have a back-to-back tomorrow night at Phoenix. Donovan Mitchell's already been listed as out for tonight. I would be shocked if he played tomorrow night at Phoenix. That doesn't make any sense. and they're going to let him rest, you know, Thursday, Friday. Then they have a Saturday, Sunday at the Lakers and Clippers, the usual LA doubleheader back-to-back situation when teams go out there. I mean, you might be right, Terry. He might miss the next six games and come back for the last one just to get some rhythm back. But that would be a good long stretch to let him rehab that knee and get it right. That's kind of what's at stake here is how healthy is he going
to
be?
Yeah, and he's not even close to right, David. It's not as if you're saying, well, he's just a little off. No, he's not going to the rim. There's something very wrong with the guy. And you just have to go do what needs to be done there. And by the way, you know, this would be an interesting thing, how his knee is in the offseason. Does that impact his decision on signing a contract extension or not? You know, sometimes when a player has an injury and you're sitting there saying, do you really want to walk away? Because everybody says it's $200 million for 4 years. I wrote this. It's actually $238 million or something like that for five, because they would pick up the last year of his contract, $38 million, tack four more onto it. Pretty good college fund.
Yeah, not too bad. All right, so what you want to see, Terry, is take the ball out of Garland's hands more, share the load, bringing it up, initiating the offense, have Strus do more of that, Porter do more of that.
Yeah, Porter too, LeVert,
LeVert, mix it up between those guys and get everybody involved and try and get that ball movement that they had. It's going to be a different look, because it's not going to all – you've compared Mitchell to being the sun and the other guys as the planets around him. Mm-hmm. This is going to be like – a lot of planets just kind of
– yeah, they are helping.
It's going to be like the Big Bang
Garland
Theory.
Garland might be more effective too, some playing off the ball, some more catch and shoot stuff and things from the outside. That might help him too. So it's JB's got a – he's got talent to pick from, David. See, that's the thing I want to stress here, because Mobley's healthy. Now, you know, I guess the Coral's had a toe thing, but, you know, he's there. LeVert's had some stuff. Those are kind of the regular knock around little injuries you get in the NBA season, LeVert and Coral. But this is still a pretty good team. Mitchell is the one that takes it to another level. But they should not go out. And now, granted, these are tough games. What did you say? Utah, Phoenix, and the double LA. But they shouldn't be losing 15 to 20 points a night in these games. They just should not. You should be able to figure out how to do it and work around it.
And got 30 Allen. Points on Sunday.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Garland shot 2 for 9, and it was just terrible. And I'm not sure what's going on with the defense either, but it has really taken a big step backwards.
Yeah, and I think they've checked out in some ways on the defense, because they know the end is near and the playoffs are coming. So that could be part of it too. So I want to ask Terry, you mentioned kind of who you thought was maybe the most underrated Cav going into the playoffs. Who is that to you? I've got a guy too.
It's Strus. I mean, I'll say that just because I think Allen this year has gotten his due, you know, maybe not nationally, but at least locally, from the guy that said the lights are too bright in New York, and I admit I stunk and people wanted to trade him, to they saw how he and Mitchell carried the team when they had so many guys who were hurt. So I moved him out of the underrated thing, and I put Strus in it because of his varied skills. You know, I thought he was primarily a shooter. I didn't realize he was as athletic as he was, and I knew he was kind of a gritty defender. Just about all of them are in Miami. But this guy's ball handling skills are good too.
I'll tell you who my guy is, Terry, who I think is the most underrated. And we've been waiting for Evan Mobley, right? Mm-hmm. And if you look at his numbers from last season to this season, there is not much difference except in one area, and that is 3-point shooting. Mm-hmm. And has there ever been a better time for Evan Mobley to take the reins on this offense and just become a guy that they can run sets for like every other time down the floor? You know, he shot about 21% on threes last season. I think he's up almost to 38%.
Yeah.
37.8 this season. And there can't really be a better time for Evan Mobley to break out and show everybody what he can do inside, outside. We know the defense, but making him one of the first offensive options, I think the time is now to get that going, so that when Donovan Mitchell comes back, they have somewhere else they can go and someone who can shoot. What do you think of that?
Well, it also creates room for Allen inside, and his shot does look a lot better, because if you could float him out to the perimeter, Then you're getting a little bit of one thing like Lauri Markkanen, and that's why he fit with those guys, because, you know, he was a seven-footer, could make three-pointers. And even though he seemed sort of awkward at times as a small forward, the shooting helped make up for it. And so I'm very pleased on that. Yeah, when looking back at Mobley, I think one of the mistakes they made with him, and I understand they were just ecstatic to get him at number three, is they started with, you know, HOF, the Hall of Fame thing, and that. It was just, that could be something quiet, but you don't lay, I wouldn't lay that on him. On a 19-year-old played 1 year at USC. It's just too much. And let's see what he develops into before you start going down that road. But the nice thing is this year where he had minor knee surgery and then a serious sprained ankle, he's bounced back from both to be productive right now when they need him. So that's really encouraging.
All right, well, it's going to be an interesting last 10 games here, or 7 games, sorry, it was 10 last week. And the playoffs are at stake, and Chris Fuhrer has been writing about this, and you've been writing about there are jobs at stake, and if this thing doesn't work, if it's not progressing, there's going to be a lot of hard questions asked. So we'll see. They have a tough road trip coming up. So, and speaking of road trips, Terry, the reason the Cavs are out of town on this long trip is because of the Women's Final Four coming to town. They're going to be down at Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse. The games are Friday night, and Sunday at 3 is the championship. Friday night, we are going to have South Carolina against NC State. And then the nightcap at 9:30 will be UConn against Caitlin Clark and Iowa. And you have a really interesting Caitlin Clark angle this week that I had not realized until you told me. Terry, go ahead. Why don't you talk about Caitlin Clark and the local connection?
Earlier in the year, Cleveland State played at Iowa. Chris Kilsmeyer, the coach of Cleveland State. By the way, they've won 59 games in the last 2 years, Cleveland State's women's team. I thought the game was just at Iowa, you know, on campus. It turned out it was played at the Wells Fargo Center in Des Moines, like basically a three-pointer away from where Caitlin Clark grew up. So they walk in, and this is a Caitlin Clark homecoming festival. I mean, there's 15,000 people there, all waving signs, and, you know, and Clark's talking about she has chills because she played on the court to win state titles. And here's Cleveland State walking into this. And on top of it, Kilsmeyer, the coach, grew up in Iowa. And as he said to me, he's 48 years old. He said, when I was a kid, a lot of the girls' basketball programs in high school, they were playing six-player basketball. That's where only three in backcourt and three in the front court. It started to go away in 85 there. It didn't go totally away till the 94 playoffs. So you go from this sort of primitive basketball to it's showtime, you know. And so Chris himself said he had over 100 relatives and friends in the crowd, and because he grew up in Iowa, he went to Iowa State. You know, this was a very big deal for him, and of course, all the women on his team had circled the date. I mean, they lost. Let me see here. You know, 105-74. You know, Clark had like her usual game. She went for 38 and 9-16 on threes. But he said, even though you look at tape and that, he said, what really strikes you when you're watching it in person is she's faster than she looks on tape, just moving down, you know, just the long strides and everything. And her court vision is superb. You know, she's leading the country, not just in scoring, but also in assists. I mean, she really does make, kind of like a little bit what we talked about Mitchell and that, making your teammates better. And so he just said, it was a great experience. He wished that his kids had played better. He goes, so we gave up 100 points. He goes, the other night I'm watching LSU, and they hung 90 points on LSU. So, hey, it happens. You know, I'm not going to sit here and be embarrassed by that. But it was one of those moments where he realized, thinking back to when he grew up, and some of the high schools around them were playing this. And he's only 48. He's not 148. We're playing this six-player basketball to that, 15,000 people. You know, it's as if this is, I mean, she may be like the biggest Iowa basketball legend ever by the time this is done.
Yeah, it's crazy to think about. And for people who don't know the three-on-three thing, Terry, it was like you had three people play offense and three play defense, and they could not go over the half-court line, right?
Yeah, you either were assigned to playing on one side of the half-court line or on the other, and that was it.
And it was a big deal in Iowa. They loved that they had this different brand of basketball back in the day, but it's crazy how far it's coming. And, you know, there's been a lot written about Caitlin Clark, and just – you know, you talk about this in your Faith in You column sometimes, Terry, about how one decision can really make a difference. And she was down to Notre Dame in Iowa, and she actually committed to Notre Dame and didn't announce it or anything, and then thought about it for a couple of days and decided she wanted to stay home. And it's just wild to think about how different things might have been if she had gone to Notre Dame. I mean, she's like an Iowa folk hero now with the way things have turned out. The all-time leading scorer in the history of basketball, college basketball, men or women. And she decided to stay home. And I don't think she ever could have fathomed that things would have gone the way they've gone. It's wild.
You're going to like this. So they play UConn tonight. Play UConn on Friday night, I think at like 9:30, whatever it is.
Yep.
UConn, the epitome of women's college basketball. She was not recruited by them. Not that she would like think about this at all or anything, but as she said, they did sort of talk to the coaches, but never really reached out to her or her family. Whereas just about everybody else was after. I mean, she was a big, big time player in high school there. Her grandfather was, I think it's called Dowling High School in Des Moines. Her grandfather was a football coach there. Her father played at Simpkins College, and then her brothers played sports at the high school. So it's a very athletic family. You know, it was the basketball games with the brothers in the driveway and all that kind of stuff. She has a 3.6 GPA in marketing, which she's going to be coming handy with all she's got going already, which she already has All-State commercials and other things. So it's just a really nice story. But I've seen two women that when I first saw them, my mouth in terms of basketball players just like fell open. And the first was in the late 70s, 1977. I am at Greensboro, a young writer, and they sent me to cover this college all-star game. Now, this is real the infancy of college basketball sports for women, 77. But they were there. And I had heard about this Nancy Lieberman, but I had never seen her. So, and there, this is like, she's at Old Dominion, and it's like, by the way, the Player of the Year award in college basketball is a Nancy Lieberman award. So anyway, I'm watching this game, and I'm going, she's going behind her back. She's going, she's got double pump fake. She's going to the rim. She really played like what she was, which was a New York City, Far Rockaway, New York style playground player. And it was completely different. Now, you see a lot of that now, but that was brand new. And then Clark comes along, and we've had many, many great women basketball players since, but she's shooting from Steph Curry land. And she's averaging, she's doing her Magic Johnson thing, she's averaging close to a triple-double. And so I'm like, to watch how the game has changed, and in like Kielmeyer's mind, from the 6-on-6 or 3-on-3, however you want to call it, to this, it's just remarkable. And it's so much fun. Boy, how many people do you think at the NCAA, wherever, were really pulling for Iowa to beat LSU for that Final Four game in Cleveland?
Well, and Tim Bielek, our colleague, he put up a post on cleveland.com earlier today. The women's Final Four tickets are selling for, I think, about 33% more than the men's Final Four tickets. And a lot of that goes back to the players have to stay in school longer in the women's game than the men's game. They can't jump to the WNBA. And Caitlin Clark, this will be her last year. Obviously, she'll be turning pro. But I think that having the players stick around, it's very reminiscent of like the Bird Magic era, when players had to stay 2 or 3 years in college, and these rivalries would build, and there'd be, you know, one-on-one matchups you'd want to see because something happened the year before. And I think the women's game, because of having the players stay in college longer, is benefiting from those storylines, and really just people are just gravitating toward that. It's been something to watch. Like that game last night, that LSU-Iowa game, I think it got huge ratings, bigger than last year's championship game, which was, I think, was on ABC. And last night was on ESPN, a cable network, and I think it still got about 10 million viewers.
Well, I mean, it's growing. Now, people say, you have to see this woman play. You have to see it. That's if you like basketball, you got to see it. And then, so I stuck, I was watched the second game, which was USC, Lindsey Gottlieb, who was an assistant coach here briefly. She's at USC with her star freshman, a lady named Juju Watkins, who was terrific. And then, you know, so that they were, and they were playing UConn. And of course, UConn is the legendary program. And this Paige Beckers, Paige was actually the player of the year before Caitlin went to Iowa. And then she'd been out for a couple of years with injuries. And she is a lot of fun to watch, too. So these games, I think they're just going to be terrific. And I am just so glad it's here right in our backyard. And even if you can't get in, you don't want to put out $1,500 for a ticket online, tune it in.
Yeah, and even beyond that, Terry, on Saturday, there's going to be an all-star game that they've initiated for the, I think they used to have one about 20 years ago, and they brought it back. But players who aren't participating in the Final Four, they're hoping to get some big names to play in that on Saturday. And then what we're also going to have on Saturday is the NCAA opens practices to the public. And you can just show up down at Rocket Mortgage Fieldhouse and watch the teams practice, and which is really good. Oh, and that reminds me, we have two stories today. Ashley Bastock, who covers the Browns for us, was actually at the last Women's Final Four in 2007 and wrote, she went down for the public practices, and she said it was one of the most memorable moments of her childhood. And
I read
she highly recommends it. Yeah.
It's a fantastic story that Ashley wrote. Ashley went on to play at John Carroll on, I think, one or two of their NCAA teams. So, you know, it was just so cool to read that. And we, especially males, can get caught in our little box of how we see that. And we forget that there are a lot of women out there and girls who are looking at these players and picking up on, gee, you know, I can do that too. Roberta was on the very first women's basketball team at Hiram, which, by the way, was 1975. Think about that. They didn't even have a team there until then. And she was a senior. So, by the way, they played that three-man game at her high school. She didn't go out. She didn't like it. So she waited until college to go out. But just to see how it's changed.
All right, lots of basketball this weekend. And you can, like Terry said, you can participate in a number of ways, watching, going down, and championship game Sunday at 3 o'clock. So, all right, Terry, let's take a break. When we come back, we are going to talk about the Guardians, and maybe we'll do like the good, the bad, and the unusual that we've seen so far. We'll get into that, and we'll have some more of your letters about foul balls when we return on Terry's Talking. We're back on Terry's Talking. David Campbell and Terry Pluto. We're going to get into some baseball here. Terry, the Guardians are off to a 3-2 start. They're a game and a half behind the Detroit Tigers, who are in first place in the AL Central.
Somebody's got to be in first in the Central.
That's true. And the Twins are in second.
Somebody has to do it. Yeah.
So anyway, it's early in the season. I thought we could do maybe the good, the bad, and then I maybe the quirky. I've got a little stat that I wanted to throw your way here in a minute. But what are you seeing that you like so far from the Guardians in their first five games, and they're playing at Seattle late tonight? So
okay,
go ahead,
Freeman in center. I mean, I actually was kind of encouraged on that because I thought a shortstop with the right training should be able to play the outfield. If you're a good enough athlete to play short, you should be able to figure out how to play the outfield. But you know, he threw a guy out the plate yesterday, and that was really good. The feeling was if he gets enough at bats, he can hit 280 or so. And, you know, he's hit a home run. He's hit the ball hard several times. So we can't talk about center field as no offense, at least so far. So that's a very big positive. And then the other, you know, I'm big on the bullpen, all kinds of worries about the bullpen. Bullpen's been good so far. We'll see how that goes. But there were two guys that I think, one I was high on, the other I just didn't see him to know. You know, Hunter Gaddis, I thought if you put him in the bullpen, you just tell him to throw hard, maybe once in a while throw a slider or something. He had a chance to be a good one-inning guy, and that looks like that's the case. But Kate Smith is another one that looks like that. So that could be how this bullpen issue could be salvaged, is if you get a couple of these young guys with really strong arms that could chew up some innings. Now, I was warned by a top baseball person I respect when the Guardians traded for Barlow, that he's relying way too much on his slider, and he's just not the guy who was a couple of years ago with that ERA under 3. And we've seen it. You know, he seems to be going deep in counts. His fastball is 90, 91. And that's a concern because if he can't be the eighth inning guy or, you know, they tied up over, $7 million in this guy too. That's part of the reason they, you know, this was their one big investment was bringing Barwell in. So that's a concern. I thought McKenzie looked terrible. He was throwing 88 to 90. Things were high. He seemed to have no rhythm. It's only one start, so let's see how that goes. But if I were them, I would be concerned.
The bullpen pitched 4 2/3 innings with 7 strikeouts, no walks, and 3 hits. But it was an early exit by Tristan McKenzie. What looks off to you with him?
His release point or something. Yeah, so many pitches up high. And he just isn't you know, he isn't a 95 to 97 guy in velocity, but he was like 89 to 91. And breaking ball, I don't know, he just seemed off. So let's see what else comes up. You know, because of the illness in our family, Robert and I were not able to go to spring training. So I really was at a deficit in terms of trying to evaluate some of these guys or seeing things. And the first time in 30 years, by the way, didn't get to go to spring training, so missed that. And I now realize how valuable it is when I didn't have it, because talking to different people. But I did talk to some people who were down there, and that's where I was kind of worn at. And then the other thing that's a concern is Esteban Florio. I was told he loves to chase that high fastball, and he's got an uppercut swing, and he swings and swings and swings. And that's pretty much what we've seen. He drilled a double and then barely made it into third. He probably shouldn't have tried it, but at least he crushed one ball. But that's, you know, they're hoping for more out of him, and maybe they will get more. But the things that I was warned about with him, I see. The same thing with Barlow. The things that I was warned about by some people down there, we've seen early in the year. So those are the two disconcerting things. The young guys in the bullpen are a big positive. Freeman in center, big positive. Jimenez is swinging the ball with the bat very well. He's the best second baseman I've seen since Robbie Alomar. I mean, he's just phenomenal.
That's some high praise.
He's phenomenal. And maybe he's going to go back to like hitting like he was 2 years ago, where he was really productive. And then, you know, the nice thing, I mean, they got the guy signed for like 7 years or something. So that's, if he becomes an all-star, and if he could start hitting 270, 280 with an OPS around 800, and he might, you know, you could have an all-star here for a long time, tied up for a long time.
Yeah, he's already got the gold glove and the platinum glove defensively. Check out Hoynes. He's got a story on cleveland.com/guardians about apparently Jimenez has been listening to salsa music for years to get his feet. He dances to the salsa music, and he says that really helps him with his footwork. So that there's the secret behind the defensive
ability
stardom.
To go down and jump up and be on balance, that was a Robbie Alomar thing, is phenomenal. The other guy who could do it, Omar. Omar did not have a strong arm, but that quick feet and all those things. I just remember this is just unbelievable. I wish I could find, it was on ESPN. It was one of their analytics guys who was basically writing why Omar does not belong in the Hall of Fame. And he goes, if you really look at it analytically, he's not much better than Larry Brown. I'm going, Larry Brown played during the 60s. I saw Larry Brown. And excuse me, sir. Larry Brown is no Omar Vizquel. With all due respect to Larry Brown, who was a nice, very average player. I saw him. You have no clue. But we mentioned, like Hoyne said, the salsa feet or whatever. Boy, Omar and Jimenez, they got it.
All right. Well, Terry, I did want to recap. We've been doing the good and the bad here. The Cleveland starters are 2-1 with a 5.01 ERA.
Yeah.
And Hoynesy had a stat today, this stat, that the starters have thrown 23 and a third innings, and the relievers have thrown 19 and two-thirds innings. Yeah. It's not far off from being 50-50 there, and that's going to have to change. So, okay, so we've done the good and bad. Yeah,
and I kind of liked it. I thought Carrasco gave them what you would hope to get. Five innings, three runs. You know, if you look back to when
he game
was
close.
Yeah. And he's out there, and because it looked like he was going to die early in that game. And he got through. Granted, it's Oakland, so there's five asterisks. But nonetheless, he lasted longer than Tanner Bibee. And now, right. He's not throwing real hard. But, you know, Carlos is out there. He's throwing his off-speed stuff. And he's just, you know, kind of like how he willed himself back from leukemia. It's like he's sort of willing himself back for, like, one more year.
Yeah, he's something else. All right, so before we wrap up the Guardian story, I wanted to share this. Mike Petrello, he writes for MLB.com. He had a funny tweet, X, whatever you want to call it these days. Mm-hmm. And he was looking at Baseball Savant, and he said, this is the funniest stat I've seen all day. The lowest ground ball percentage, and I think this was before today's game on Tuesday, the Guardians have the lowest ground ball percentage this season of every major league team, 32.9%. And this Cardinals are second at 33.9. And basically, this is just a measure of how many balls that you put in play are ground balls. And somebody said to him, why is that the funniest stat? And he said, well, Cleveland hasn't had like an outfielder hit 30 home runs since like 1916 or something.
Yeah.
And that's why he thought it was funny. But people, you know, who are Cleveland baseball fans, they know this team, and Antonetti has talked about this a lot, is we don't need to hit home runs. We need to score more runs.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of ties back to that. If you're not hitting ground balls and you're getting line drives and you're, I mean, they could have had a couple more hits last night if it wasn't for a couple of great defensive plays by Seattle. But if you're hitting line drives and putting the ball in play in a hard way, you're going to be getting more doubles, triples. They're up, way up there in extra base hits so far this season. So I thought that was interesting in terms of the Guardians' approach. Like, yeah, they're not hitting a ton of home runs, but this is a good sign so far. I think that they're actually, and you talked about, you know, last season, all the guys who were putting the ball in play but not hitting it hard.
Yeah.
And this is kind of a reflection that I think guys are hitting it a little harder, at least so far. So
yeah, well, they had a lot of doubles, and that's really good. You know, Rocchio's off to a nice start. That's another thing to mention. So there's, you know, some encouraging things. I mean, so much of it is asterisk because Oakland is so bad. It's so bad. But nonetheless, for the most part in that series, you know, they caught the ball. And they ran the base as well. Those are things that looked like, let's put it this way. It looked like they had a spring training anyway. Some of these, you wonder what did Oakland do? I mean, it was like, I'm sure it's not Kotze, the manager's fault. He's been around forever. It's just like, what do you want me to do? Everybody's like just thinking about Vegas. I mean, you know, I just got whoever I got. So, so that's been the fun part there.
And I guess we could have put this under the good category, Terry, but the base running and the steals have been, I think that's going to be a pretty fun brand of baseball for fans to watch this season. If they can keep that up, double steals, they're taking extra bases, and they were doing it in Oakland against one of the best throwing catchers in the game. So if that continues all season, I think that's going to be really exciting for fans, even if they're on a ton of home runs. So,
and also if you steal a couple bases off a catcher, he becomes discouraged. Because either because the pitcher isn't holding on right, or the new rules won't let me, don't give me a chance. It's just like a guy that keeps hitting line drives that are caught. You begin to think, I'll never get a hit. Now you're hitting pop-ups. Well, then the next thing, like that catcher where he's making pretty good throws, but the guy's not holding him on. Now all of a sudden the ball's sailing into the outfield. It's bouncing. It just goes in a bad direction.
All right, so the Guardians are continuing on their trip, and they will be going to Texas after they're done in Seattle, and then the home opener is on Monday, the 8th of April, and there will be an eclipse around 3 o'clock and then a baseball game around 5. The weather looked pretty good the last I saw. It looked sunny and in the 60s, so it's all good news for Monday. So get your eclipse glasses, and then you can watch the Guardians open the home season. So, all right, on to the Browns, Terry. I don't know. Do we want to talk about Cade York anymore this week, or what do you think?
I'm glad they have another kicker in there. I mean, I'm not ready to write him off. He's a backup. But I just want a real kicker who's at least been in some games that you could bring in case Hopkins has another pulled muscle, of which he's had several during his NFL career. So, fine. You know, it's a guy they kind of like, and if not, they go get somebody else. But I did not like the idea of Well, in fact, last training camp, they didn't even have another kicker in there. Cade York was the only one.
Yeah, and the thing is, he's got leg, and you know, it's like they say, you can always teach a shooter to play defense, right? You can always teach a long kicker to be more accurate.
They say that stuff is not always true, but we can find out. I mean, Phil Dawson was cut 3 times before he stuck with the Browns. 3 times. And there's a lot of other examples of guys who've been cut and bounced around. And I believe Hopkins was also cut at least once, if not twice, early in his career.
All right. Yeah, man, that Phil Dawson stat is crazy. 3 times he was cut before he made the Browns, huh? That's something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he documented them all. I think I could only find 2. But he also talked about this weird tryout in Pittsburgh for 1 day, but they had him in there. And he's like, he couldn't even figure out why they had him in. It's like, they had him kick like 5 times, and we'll get back to you.
So, Terry, we're coming up on the draft, which is about 3 weeks away here on the 25th. The Browns won't have a first-round pick again this year because of the Watson trade. But they've made a lot of moves this offseason to fill in holes on their roster. Which is your favorite move that you think was the best one in terms of fit so far this offseason?
I'm throwing this one to you first. What is your favorite move?
So I thought about this, and I like the Jordan Hicks move because –
Oh, you took my guy.
Did I
that
really?
That is not fair.
See, it just goes to show. We don't talk before fair. The podcast. So it's 2 years, $8 million, which is a really good number.
Mm-hmm.
I know middle linebackers are being kind of devalued in the NFL these days, but this is a guy who played for Jim Schwartz for 3 seasons. It's a good contract. And when you lose Anthony Walker, a guy who was kind of the traffic cop in the middle of the defense, I think Jordan Hicks is kind of guy you can plug right in there and can do the same kind of thing. So I'm sorry I stole your guy. Is there anything you can
Let's hope Jerry Jeudy is it, but I'm not going to go down that road because that was a trade and that. All right, who else do you like? I'm just going to kind of go, because you see if you get my second guy.
Oh, man.
It's kind of uneventful.
Shelby Harris, is he your second guy?
He's up there. I do like Shelby Harris. And I also just like, this is a real underrated one, I like Hurst, if he could stay healthy.
The two tackles. He made some big plays last year.
Yes, he did. And so, you know, those are the type of players. They're not necessarily the best, just kind of signings that you like. But I'm stunned you had Hicks first. I should have just went out of the gate with it. But I really wanted to see, though, you know, the problem with Anthony Walker is he gets hurt all the time. I mean, he's a great guy and all that. You know, Hicks has been able to stay on the field most of his career. And they do need that, you know, type of thing going. Would it surprise you if they took a cornerback as their first pick?
At 54, it would not. But nope. And we can get more into this as we get closer to the draft. I really would like to see them bolster that safety room mm-hmm. a little bit, because they had some injuries there, and Grant Delpit's history of injuries. They're susceptible. They're young back there. They've been banged up. I just think getting some good quality depth in the second, third round, and some special teams guys also that would be able to do both
mm-hmm.
could be the way to go. But we can talk more about that closer to the draft.
I'm a little – well, first of all, I always think kind of defensive backs, especially cornerbacks, are a little bit like pitchers. They get hurt. They're a little fragile. You'd seem like this one, you think you have enough. Suddenly, by week 14, some guy that they pulled off the street is starting. I mean, it almost always happens that way. And so you want to try to avoid that. Just like, you know, I wrote a thing about for last Sunday about loading up areas where you have injuries hanging over things. You know, you load up the quarterback area. And so you have Tyrell Huntley and you have Jameis Winston. And you have DTR. And then you load up the running back. And Mary Kay made a good thing that I completely forgot about, DTR having that big hip injury at the end of the year that they didn't talk much about. Maybe there's a reason there's Tyrell Huntley in here, too, for that.
Yeah, yeah. That was because he had the concussion, too, and the hip thing. You're right. It kind of got forgotten.
Yeah, the hip thing,
Terry,
at the end of the
year. That's a big injury.
Yes, it is. Yeah. And so that was a problem there. And then you go with the running backs. You know, they brought in. I always kind of like Foreman as a short yardage guy. He's bounced around, but, you know, the adequate guy. And, you know, we'll see what Jerome Ford could really do now, you know, knowing he's going to be playing quite a bit. Because let's get off of this Nick Chubb going to play in September or whatever. That it's not fair to Chubb. He's going to talk about wanting to do it then, and that's fine. And, you know, you never underestimate Nick Chubb. But I just think one of the worst things you can do when a guy has had both ACL and MCL surgery, had them 2 months apart. Remember, it wasn't one shot. They had to go in there twice. That's the same knee that had a whole bunch of scar tissue in it from that big surgery he had in 2015 at Georgia. Make sure that knee is right. We may not really see the Nick Chubb fully back. I'm not saying he won't be on the field, but how good Nick Chubb can be, I think, until 2025. I really believe that. Which is why you may want to make sure if you could work some kind of contract where you have some options for him, you know, with 24, roll it into 25. I would try to keep him under team control, because it's kind of like a pitcher coming off Tommy John or whatnot. You just sometimes he comes back, maybe he's not ready, or just the thing is not as strong. Nah, he's not that good. You let him go, and then he goes somewhere else, and he's ready to go. Now he looks sort of like himself.
Well, if anybody can come back from it, it's him. But the other thing, Terry, like you said, it's a lot of wear and tear on those knees.
Yeah.
And the only thing that Andrew Berry said was that he has not taken his last snap as a Cleveland Brown. That's as far as Andrew Berry would go, because I don't think he was going to say, oh, yeah, he's going to be starting for us and this, that, and the other. That was all he would say, and I think that was a fair statement.
Yeah, and also with Andrew Berry, basically, he does not want anything attached to his name that's going to kind of come bounce back on him. And so did you listen to Winston's press conference and everything? What did you think of that?
I did not, but I read the transcript, and yeah. I thought that he really – set the tone for what he wants to be for mm-hmm. this team, and as not just a backup quarterback, but also a mentor to a guy who's younger than him. And you know, I think we talked about this, just about the things they have in common, and they've kind of lived a lot of the same things. And it seems like it's going to be a good pairing. So,
I mean, there was, you know, when I really delved more into the Winston thing, I mean, look, I love Flacco too. This is aside from that, it began to make a lot more sense to me than when I first heard it. And then when they picked up Tyler Huntley, because he's just floating around out there, because I always kind of liked him. I'm like, great. You could put him in the game too. Since last year, Jeff Driscoll, you could win some money on that one. I always forget that he started that last game. Because remember, DTR is out then. And so, like, okay, line him up.
Quarterback number 5.
Yeah.
All right. Hey, Terry, about a month ago, you invited fans to send in their stories of foul balls that they caught at a game, and we've gotten some really good ones. We're going to try to keep working through them since we're into baseball season, and they're really fun to read. So this first one comes to us from Ron Richner, and he lives in Hilton Head Island, South Carolina, where I'm sure it's beautiful, not like here today. And here's what he says. I've been an Indians, Guardians, Browns, and more recently Cavs fan for all of my 75 years. I grew up in Northwest Ohio, only 90 miles from Detroit, but 150 miles from Cleveland. Most of my friends were Tigers and Lions fans, and I was a distinct minority. My first major league game was in Briggs Stadium. Fast forward through the 50s, 60s, and 70s, listening to Jimmy Dudley scouring the box scores for their wealth of information, to June 1982. My friend Dave and I attended a Twilight doubleheader. Remember those in old Tiger Stadium? Tiger Stadium was built much like Municipal Stadium in Old Comiskey. The roof over the upper deck was supported by pillars, the seats behind which were a dead zone. Our seats for this classic were in the first row of the upper deck in right field, immediately next to the right field foul line in fair territory, but not behind a pillar. You could look straight down on the top of the right fielder. Len Barker for the Tribe and Jack Morris for the Tigers were locked in a classic pitcher's duel. The Tribe led 1-0 heading into the bottom of the seventh. Barker was sailing along until Kirk Gibson led off the bottom of the seventh with a single. Jerry Turner, a little left-handed hitter, stepped in and lofted a high, deep drive right down the right field line, headed for the upper deck and headed directly at me. As the ball got closer, according to Dave sitting next to me, I took a wide stance, elbows out, and caught the home run on the fly. The Tiger fans around me were cheering wildly and pounding on my back. What I wanted to do was throw it back on the field in disgust. I did
not. Don't do it. Don't do it. It's your ball.
He says both pitchers threw complete games and the Tigers won 2-1. After leaving the second game early, Dave and I went to my aunt and uncle's house in Westland, Michigan. My uncle had been listening to the game on radio and was very excited about the Tigers' win. Early, Ernie Harwell, the great Tigers radio voice, had a shtick where when a Tiger hit a home run in the stands, he would say, "And a young man from Hamtramck is going home with that Tiger blast." My uncle excitedly told me Ernie had used that line in the game. I showed him the ball and said, "I'm that young man." I still have that ball in my collection along with the box score of the game. It's funny how my most cherished game ball experience was the direct result of yet another Tribe loss. So,
well,
there you go. Thanks for that, Ron.
To roll this far, this is the second time somebody's rolled in about a story from when I was covering the Tribe, which I know I was there. I was on the beat, and I was the Orioles in 79, and I was Cleveland 80 through 84 on baseball. Then it later switched over to the Cavs. So I was obviously at that doubleheader, which I remember nothing about, other than that right field, I believe it was an optical illusion, but you would swear while watching it that the right field upper deck in Briggs actually hung over the playing field. Because it seemed like the right fielder would be going back thinking he's going to catch the ball, and it just didn't come down. It landed in this guy's hands
Right. Yeah.
So that's a cool story.
Yeah, those are the great old stadiums that hung over like that. They didn't go back and up the way the ones now do, and you could hear everything on the field because you were so close. So, all right, this last one is from Alan Mancuso, and Al says, actually, no, Alan, he said he ran into you. Well, I'll just read the letter. He says, I've lived in Cleveland, and currently I live on the near west side in Ohio City. I say this to say I'm a lifelong Cleveland resident and sports fan, except for a short period when I was a New York Jets fan. I actually had the honor of meeting you, Terry, once at the Carnegie West Library branch. So, and he says, wow. I have a question and a story. I'd like to know if you have any insight as to why former Cleveland baseball team ended the broadcast team of Joe Tate and Bruce Drennan. I thought they were the best by far. They were the most entertaining, in my unhumble opinion. Nev Chandler and Doug Deacon were spectacular, too. So we can get into that in a second, Terry. And he says, here's my story. I remember the foul ball that I didn't catch. I was at a Guardians game in the early 80s with my mom's sister and my sister's friend. My mom sent me to get food for all of us at the concessions. And as I was walking back to our seats in upper right field, I noticed the Cecil Cooper of the Brewers was at bat. I got to our row when all of a sudden Cecil hits a foul ball coming right at us. In that time, I had to make a decision. Drop all the food and risk the ire of my mom and go for the foul ball or hope my mom would get it. I was around 8 years old, so I chose the latter. Wrong choice. The foul ball came screaming in right toward my mom as I watched in anticipation of having my first ever foul ball. The ball hit her in the foot, and the guy in the row in front of us got it. I was so mad. I really wanted that ball. Of course, I got over it fairly quickly, and that is from Al Mancuso. Thanks, Al, for that. So, Al, about Al's question about what happened with Joe Tate and Bruce Drennan were together at one point, huh?
Yes, they were. They brought Bruce in from Aurora, Illinois. He was sort of a talk show host and that, and the powers that be thought the combination wasn't real good. But then they came up, and I hope my memory is right, then they came up with putting Joe Tate on TV with Reggie Rucker, the football player, because who had played there. And that was a weird pairing. That was very strange, where Tate would kind of make fun of Drennan and, you know, they livened it up that way. That was just odd. And so then later on, Joe then just switched totally over to basketball after that.
Huh. All right. Well, there you go. Thanks for the letters. Hey, if you want to hit us with a comment, question, a foul ball story, you can send that to us at sports@cleveland.com and put Terry's talking in the subject line. We'll keep doing these until there's no more. So we appreciate you sending those in. So I think that's it, Terry. I think we're done. Anything else you want to get into?
No, I am all finished. I am going to go back to just typing up my little stories. But congratulations to, by the way, at the Copley Post Office this morning, I did see Jim Stone, not the former East Tech basketball player, but a loyal listener. And then also there, the hot, great place to be, the Copley Post Office, I still live in West Akron, was Drew Joyce II. So we were there talking. He is now the patriarch of the great coaching family, because, of course, Cameron Joyce, his one son, won the state title at St. Ignatius. And Drew III is taking over for Keith Danbrot at Duquesne as the head coach. And we were just chatting about how, you know, Drew number two started as a youth basketball coach with his son, Drew III, who made friends with LeBron. And they picked up other guys, Willie McGee and those other guys along the way. And then Keith Danbrot was coaching at St. V. They went over to there. Drew went as assistant. At that point, he was doing very well as a medical supply salesman. And, you know, how life comes. You know, LeBron came into the life. And otherwise, he was going to be a youth coach for a long time. He helped out at Buckdell High School. And then next thing you know, I think he's won 7 titles at St. V himself. And his sons are just doing tremendous work. So it was just fun. And by the way, he was mailing packages just like me.
that's what happens at the post office.
That's what you do. Yeah,
it's crazy to think about, like, that St. V team that Keith Danbrot kind of got put together at St. V, and then he left and Drew took over and won more state championships. And it's hard. Now LeBron is in his, 21st NBA season, and these guys are becoming head coaches. And, man, the time has gone so fast, but it's really been remarkable to watch. I remember watching Drew when he was a freshman at St. V, and he was probably not even 6 feet at that point.
Oh, no, little Drew, he was like 5'3", making all these threes. LeBron just kept throwing it to him.
And Maverick Carter.
They were cooking. So it was a lot of fun to see that. And then for years, Drew II had to prove that he could be a good coach without LeBron or without Keith Danbrot. And so he had to overcome that. And by the way, it was a fascinating story, just a side story on Drew III. Was played in Germany for 10 years. He's like one of the all-time great German basketball players. And then he came home and he was hired by Dennis Gates as an assistant coach. And so he was there two years with Dennis Gates or three. But anyway, when Gates left, Drew III applied for the job, but he didn't get it. Daniel Robinson got a great hire, by the way, by Scott Garrett. No knock on Drew III, but Daniel been like kind of a veteran assistant like Gates, and that's what they were looking for. Well, Keith Danbrot swooped in, and he was coming off a tough year. I think they lost over 20 games, and he asked Drew to come over with him to Duquesne. It was almost like, let's get the band together, because, you know, he wanted to kind of keep his job and also set up little Drew, as he's still known there, to succeed him. And, of course, that 2 years later, that's what's happened.
Pretty remarkable, and I know you're working on a column on that whole arrangement too, which will be really fun to read. So, all right, Terry, I think we are good. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Don't forget to sign up for Terry's newsletter. You can go to cleveland.com/newsletters and just click on Terry's newsletter. You'll get everything he does every Monday. Thanks again. We'll catch you next week. Enjoy all the basketball, and we'll talk to you soon on Terry's Talking.